Hey, everybody, this is Sunny. Just FYI, this episode came out a couple weeks ago. We're talking about Arnold, the documentary about Arnold Schwarzenegger that's on Netflix. Fun talk, good times. We had a great bonus episode, Arnold Schwarzenegger draft, movie draft. We drafted lineups of Arnold Schwarzenegger movies. That was a lot of fun. You can vote on it at the Patreon. Go sign up there at subbeacon.com. You'll easily find it. And enjoy this episode.
There was a lot of things they had to learn. Obstacles that they had to overcome. You can get an injury, then all your athletic stuff is over. But the only thing that no one can take from you is your mind.
Arnold Schwarzenegger terminated his box office competition.
I was looking for another challenge. Politics.
Let's get to work.
Welcome to the Sub Beacon Podcast. I'm your co-host, Mike Warren. With me, as always, are my two co-hosts who know what is best in life, Jonathan V. Lest and Sonny Bunch. Come on over to subbeacon.com where you can become a patron. Get first access to episodes every Friday. Get exclusive access to bonus episodes. Join the Sub Beacon community where you can comment and vote in polls. Lots of fun over there at subbeacon.com. On today's episode, we're going to be talking about Arnold, the limited documentary series available on Netflix later on in the show. But first, guys, how are we doing? JVL, you've got nothing for us today. Is that correct?
I just told you everything in the green room over the course of 15 minutes, and it's amazing, and it is not for public consumption.
No, no one's ever going to hear that.
Sonny, Michael, what do you boys have?
Sonny, hit us.
What's going on with me? Big news. Mm-hmm. I finally saw, Oppenheimer as God and Christopher Nolan intended on the IMAX.
The 70 millimeter?
The IMAX 70 millimeter. There's 19 of these theaters in the country. We happen to have one of them in Dallas, yeah. Texas.
Did they talk louder?
15. The sound sounds a little bit, it's a lot. It's interesting.
Were the boobs bigger?
I have always been.
No, they're not.
Yeah. I have always been fairly ambivalent about Christopher Nolan's use of IMAX, despite being, a registered, the Foreign Agents Registration Act. They have one of those for Christopher Nolan shills, the Christopher Nolan shill Registration Act, KINRA, we call it. As a fully enrolled KINRA. I have always been a total Christopher Nolan shill. It's fine. I've accepted my lot in life, but I have always been a little bit ambivalent about how he uses IMAX, particularly in the years, since Inception came out, really starting with The Dark Knight Rises. Because he does this thing when you see it in IMAX where the aspect ratios are constantly shifting. 'Cause some of the stuff he shoots with, an IMAX certified camera, and sometimes he shoots it with like the big full box IMAX, 4x3 essentially aspect ratio, that is extremely distracting. I've always found that to be extremely distracting. It's not even like there's no real rhyme or reason to it, except by what he is limited in his ability to shoot in any given circumstance. So, like in Dunkirk, for instance, you will get shots within the same scene. You'll go from the full IMAX aspect ratio to like 2.35:1, or 1.8:1, or whatever it is, and then back, you cut back and forth, and it's extremely distracting. I don't like it. It pulls you out of the moment. Once upon a time with like Inception. That The Dark Knight and Inception, when he switched to the full IMAX ratio, that just meant like action scene,
big action.
We're doing big action, and like we're shooting this in IMAX, and it's big action. And like that's it. That's fine. I think that's okay. But how he uses it in Dunkirk, and to a lesser extent in Tenet. Tenet is mostly in the IMAX AR, but. But also in Oppenheimer, he does the same thing. He's switching back and forth. That said, seeing it
right in the conference room scenes, he's in normal aspect ratio, and in the hearing room scenes, He goes full IMAX.
No, but that's not even right. That's not in the hearing room scenes, some of the shots are in full IMAX aspect ratio. And then
you need them to understand.
And then some there's a lot of action.
And then
here.
Some of the shots are in, widescreen aspect ratio. It's just really I don't understand exactly what it is. I'm sure he has some explanation in his, but it doesn't. It's just distracting to me. That said, the shots that are in the full aspect ratio in Oppenheimer, I forgive because it is enormous. And like kind of overwhelming and so clear, like the 70 millimeter print that they have, that's, 11 miles or whatever of film.
Was that digitally projected?
No, they have an actual.
Oh, it's not ones and zeros?
No, it's 70 millimeters. 70 millimeter film.
Was it 600 pounds, I think?
It's some enormous. They have to ship it in 8 or 10 containers. And then they put it together once they like bring it all up to the projection room, they put it together there and they have a guy, IMAX sends a guy to each of these theaters to run the projector because you can't just have a regular projector.
Wonder why Hollywood is going bankrupt.
But these showings are selling out everywhere. I mean, like if you look at the theater I saw it at, all of the seats in the middle, stadium section, the middle part of the stadium section for literally every showing through the end of its run, 3 weeks from now, sold out. Like you cannot get a seat dead center at 10:30 at night for a showing of Oppenheimer in IMAX 70 millimeter. Like you can't do it. So anyway, it was also just like it was also the whole thing was just a lot of fun too, because the Cinemark employee there, the like guy taking tickets at Cinemark, came out and he ran people through the technology of it. He was like, look at this strip of film here. These are 24 frames. This goes through the projector every second. 24 frames. And you know what it does? It doesn't go up and down like a normal projector. Goes sideways. Goes sideways through the thing. It was.
I mean, he was doing this just for you.
It was really. It was really engrossing.
I don't think I knew that about IMAX.
Well, I think it's only. Well, so most IMAX projectors are digital. I mean, like most IMAX projectors are actually digital, right? So there aren't. But these film ones, they go through sideways, and they have like an air compressor that shoots them through. It's wild. It's a whole thing.
I just wonder, what does the semi trailer carrying the 13 miles of IMAX film. Like, what does it look like? Is it just nondescript? Does it have I've never seen it.
They break it down into normal real size canisters. And then they literally put the entire thing together in the projector room. They you remember Fight Club? You remember Fight Club?
Mike, yes.
You've seen the movie Fight Club. You're aware of this.
I've seen the movie Fight Club.
So you remember the scene in Fight Club where Tyler Durden is putting the frames of pornography into Snow White or whatever,
yes.
Or Bambi or whatever it was. How he uses that machine to clip it together.
Mm-hmm.
They have to do that for, they do that with the 10 reels to put it together and get it all up there. Anyway, it's amazing. If you have a chance to see it in this format, everybody should. I think the closest one to you guys is at the King of Prussia Mall. So I don't know. JBL, there's one in, I guess you could go to New York City. You could go to the Big Apple. See it there.
That's where I live.
The city that never sleeps.
Where is a 70 millimeter screen?
I think the AMC
The amount of
Empire?
Rent you'd have to pay for the square footage or something like that could not possibly work.
Well, New York City has a real IMAX. I think it's the AMC Empire. I don't know. I'll figure it out. But
all right. Send it to me and I will definitely think about going to see that.
You should. Since you loved it so much the first time,
it would, maybe I'd like it better.
You'd probably like it better if it was bigger. All right. Well, thanks, Sonny.
Michael, what's been going on, buddy?
Well, you're looking at a guy, you guys are talking to a guy, and listeners, you're listening to a guy who's just spent 2 days at Legoland, New York.
Goshen, New York!
In Goshen, New York.
It's 20 miles from me.
Oh, it is.
I can't believe you didn't stop by and use our house as a rest stop.
Well, we
tell me everything about it, because I'm dying to go and take the kids, but I've been a little like, I don't know. They're still working the kinks out up there.
There is a little of that, but it did not matter to my kids. So this was our big summer vacation trip because we have the baby and we were like, you know, I don't know what it's going to be like to, you know,
did all 5 of you go, or was it just you and the big boys?
Oh, all 5 of us went. It was a family vacation.
Oh,
so
great.
We drove up. I guess we did stay close to, we stayed the night before we went to the park. We stayed on points. Thank you very much. In a hotel in Mahwah. And which is right
12 miles from me.
12 miles. Okay. So,
did you go to the Wawa in Mahwah?
We did not go to the Wawa. We did not go to the Mahwah Wawa, but we went to a Wawa earlier. But so we stayed in adjoining hotel rooms, which my big boys freaking loved.
Yeah.
Freaking love. Again, on points. Thank you very much. And they loved that. We went the next morning. So the whole idea was we went the next morning and went straight into the park. We were staying at the hotel on site at the Legoland Hotel.
Which themed room did you pick?
Pirates.
Castles? Oh, pirates!
On the 4th floor, baby. Penthouse. Wow. Pirate penthouse. So we actually found out that our room was ready the morning that we got there. So we actually got out real quick, like maybe 30 minutes before the park opened, and got into our room.
Amazing. And
it was amazing. So then we went, we spent the full day, first day, it was a 2-day, you know, 2 nights at the Legoland Hotel, 2-day at the park package.
What's it like? Is it about rides or about museum stuff? Is it about stores?
It's about rides. It's about shows, if you want it to be about shows. It's about, for my 5-year-old, it's about the ability to trade minifigures. Do you know anything about this, JVL?
Oh, I know a lot about minifigures. I didn't realize that trading, did he bring a whole stash of minifigs with him to trade with kids?
Oh, strap in. Strap in this. So, not only are there trading posts all around the park, which are these little kind of square boxes on wheels where there are on all 4 sides of the platform minifigures that you can trade a minifigure you have for. No questions asked. They just have to have a head, the arms, and the legs. Like, that's all you need. Like, if you trade something and get one back that's got hats and accessories and stuff, hey, it's your lucky day.
You just struck gold. Plastic gold.
Not only are there those trading posts throughout the park, there's question, one in the hotel. Yes.
Question. So you go with your minifig and you pick which one you want off of the trading post, or you get a random one?
No. You pick which one you want and put yours on the trading post back on the little platform. So not only can you do that, but every single employee at Legoland that's wearing a name tag, has on their name tag a minifig that is attached there. And you can go up to any one of them and trade your minifig for theirs. And by the end of it, both of my kids were like studiously like looking at every single person who worked there, like, is that one I want? Is that Lloyd from Ninjago? Yeah, I want him. And my 5-year-old basically, like, after like 1 or 2 rides on the second day, like, tapped out. All he wanted to do was trade. And
wow,
yeah, he was like obsessed with it. So that was a big deal. The rides were good. They're okay, I should say. I didn't get to ride as many as I wanted to, but it's not about me. My kids were just not that into some of the rides.
What age range are the rides geared towards?
They are geared towards, I would say, age 6 to 10.
Okay.
Maybe 11 or 12.
Okay.
Some of them, so like They have one legit roller coaster that I didn't get to ride. I was kind of bummed, but my kids didn't want to do it. Most of the rides, so like my 5-year-old, who is very tall for his age, was not tall enough to ride with his brother on most of the rides, with his 9-year-old brother. Almost 9-year-old brother. Yeah. Okay, so the rides were okay. The hotel was crazy and insane and like disgusting, and my kids loved it. And
wait, disgusting how?
I have to figure out how to say this without offending people. It is like a cruise ship on land.
Yeah. It's not built for high quality.
No. The room was very cool. So they had, we were all in one room. We had a, you know, king sized bed. And then in the, there's a little alcove in the front of the room with bunk beds. And they actually had a trundle bed underneath the second bunk bed. But of course with the baby, we bought the pack and play, but that was like this own little area. And it had two spaces, like play spaces for Legos. And then it even had like a little, trough of just basic Legos, like just the colored blocks.
Build on your own.
Yeah. Build your own stuff. And yeah, after he was done training, the 5-year-old just like went back to the hotel room at like noon on the second day and just played in like with Legos the whole time while the baby slept. And me and the 8.5-year-old went out and rode some more rides. Yeah. So the hotel is not great, but it was fine. And my kids, again, they were obsessed with it. The every elevator, when the doors close, plays like disco music and has a disco ball. And so everybody's dancing, everybody's having a good time. But it's like, I was,
everything is awesome.
Not quite, you know, just like old disco stuff, YMCA and, you know, Turn the Beat Around and all that crap. There's a pool that, I didn't go to, but, Melissa took the baby and the big kid. Anyway, it's just, it's not great. There's a restaurant there that's terrible, that my kids loved. I would say they do a few really good things in the park. Lego does a great job with bathrooms. The bathrooms are all extremely clean, extremely available. Like they're everywhere. They're big. They're clean. That was not a problem. The problem solving, they're very attuned to problem solving. So the example of this is we had printed tickets, but also tickets on my phone. I was just trying to cover my bases. So on the second day, me and the big boys went right when the park was open. We were the first in the park was open. But I gave Melissa her ticket when she and the baby came in later. Well, when I went to do the phone tickets, I guess it scanned her ticket. They were just all on the phone. And so when she tried to come in like an hour and a half later, they're like, oh, this ticket has already been scanned. And she was like, oh, well, my husband and the phone and all that stuff. And they like figured it out very quickly and like let her in, basically. Like there was no like niggling over those kind of details. It was like, just go. They did that great. Here's what they did not do great. Every ride by noon, so the park opens at 10, every ride by noon 30, had at least a 20-minute wait. If not a 45-minute wait, if not a 60-minute wait, if not a 90-minute wait.
Kids rides.
Oh, it was awful. There are basically no trees. So it is built on a hill in this beautiful part of New York, in Orange County, New York, in Goshen. And the start of the park is at the top of the hill, and the rest of the park is at the bottom of the hill. And they've got one way, which is to go through Miniland, which is this, there are all these American cities built in Lego. And you basically walk down this windy, steep path, or walk up it, if the case is, to get to the rest of the park, to the pirate area in the Lego city. Or now you can go through. So it's this park's only 2 years old. They've clearly been doing some more ways to get down that are less steep. There are also now newly built stairs to cut through some of these long winding, switchback paths. But it's hot. there's no tree coverage, and it's pretty miserable walking through there. And here's my complaint. And look, this is not a Legoland complaint. This is a complaint about people. This is a complaint about human beings being awful pieces of shit from the moment that I walked into this park.
Preach. Preach, Brother Michael.
All right. So we go to the first ride, which is the Lego factory ride, which is a whole thing where you go in and you learn how to,
the Jurassic Park, the Jurassic Park ride for Legos.
Yes. But there's like a whole thing where you become a minifig and you're shrunk down and then you're put into a box and whatever.
I got dino DNA.
Exactly. Yeah. We get in line and it's early. It's the first ride we're on in the first day. And okay, so to paint the picture, so there is a steps going into the building in which you then stand in line for a while. And at the entrance, there are railings and queue lines that are empty because it's the beginning of the day and there's not that many people in line. And so we are just standing in line waiting to get into the door, standing next to these queue lines that will be used later on in the day. And at a certain point, a man comes on, like right where we are, and says, "Hey, can we basically, like, the line's starting to get long. Can you guys snake through the queue? And you'll end up basically right where you are, but it will start the snaking through the long queue line."
This man works for Lego, is an employee of the park.
Works for Lego. Okay. He's actually he's got the public safety vest on. So he's like, he's basically the cops in
Lego police.
Exactly.
Did he have minifigs to trade?
I don't remember. That was not my department. You'll have to ask the 5-year-old. And so it's very clear, like, all we are doing is taking a right, going 40 feet, snaking back 40 feet and coming right back to where we are to stay in line. Right? We are being asked to be the first to start this.
Oh,
great. This is so easy. As he's explaining this, the family behind me, I hear them say, "Not us, not us, not us, not us, not us." And I'm like, "Not us? What is that?" So then I'm like, "All right, guys, let's snake around here so we can get in, you know." And I see that family, which, by the way, is 5 grown adults and 1 little girl.
Mm.
5 grown adults and 1 little girl. And they just jump right ahead. Everybody else snakes with us. They jump right ahead. Congratulations. You're now 1 step ahead of us. But the principle of the thing, no, but I glared at them the whole time until Melissa was like,
spit on them.
No, but Melissa was like, "You've got to calm down. You have got, it is the first ride of the day." I was like, all right, I'm calm.
I'm calm. I've gotten that talk before.
I was furious. Like, everything about it was like the gaming of the system to get 1 step ahead. The fact that these are all adults and they have 1 child and they've got to jump ahead. And guess what? They rode the ride because it had like 4 different cars. And they rode the ride at the same fucking time we did. So they didn't get ahead at all. Oh, that made me so mad. So that set the tone for the rest of the two.
Why didn't the safety guy make them snake around with everybody else?
Oh, because he got out of that bitch to like go to the next one to tell them he just did that and then peaced out. There was no crowd control. And to be fair, what he should have done is used a little rope line thing to cut off.
Yeah, I don't.
The annual, but I don't. He yeah, didn't that, do that. It was a little bad. Informal.
That's,
totally.
Again, well, without is, enforcement, those are mere suggestions.
Doesn't happen at Disney. Tell you what,
this is a story. No, this is a story that played itself out several times over. Which is, the staff there had none of the discipline of Walt Disney World cast members. Like,
yeah.
So the other thing was, the rides were taking so long because every ride was understaffed. So there was like 1 person on staff running every ride. And so they would take forever just to get people moving. So that annoyed me. And then finally, like, I'm sorry, every family is communist, right? In every house, it's a communist dictatorship. And like, honestly, it should be that way in theme parks, because whatever the Legoland version of FastPass is, it had my blood boiling. Because, and I don't even blame them, because they paid the money for it. Like, that's what they're paying for. But something is wrong with standing in a line for 20, 30 minutes to ride some stupid kids ride with your kid that you don't even want to ride, but the kid is dying to ride it. And then as soon as you're about to get on the ride, you can count the number of people. Hey, we're about to get on the ride. These, most of them grown-ups, line up in the fast pass lane or whatever. It's the ride and reserve.
Capitalist running dogs, as we call them, Michael.
I hate it. It's not the point. The point is for the kids to have fun. And instead, there's all these adults riding kids' rides. What are they doing riding kids' not rides? If I didn't have to ride it that's with my 5-year-old, I wouldn't be riding the rides.
That's not the point. No, the point of this park is to make money for the Lego Corporation.
Yes,
to sell Legos. That's the point of this park. That's what the FastPass is doing.
Anyway.
Michael, I have just one question for you.
Yeah. What?
As a value proposition, mm-hmm. I want you to be very honest with yourself here.
Yep.
Whatever this very beautiful family vacation cost you, would your, from a strictly utilitarian point of view, do you think your two older boys could have gotten as much, more, or less enjoyment if you had given each of them the $300 Lego set of their dreams? The Lego set that is so expensive that they know never to ask for it. If you had dropped that puppy, the Lego Homewrecker Edition Millennium Falcon or something, you had given that to each of them and said, this is weeks, maybe even a month's worth of Lego building, joy and pleasure for you, and you'll have it for your entire lifetime. Or we can spend 72 hours and drive to Goshen, New York. Which do you think would have given them more pleasure and joy?
The 5-year-old, definitely the expensive Lego set. Absolutely. Mm. That's all he does.
But
all
the time. He wouldn't have been able to trade the minifigs.
But that is a good point. That is a good point.
Just go on eBay. You could buy a bag of 400 minifigs.
No. You have, but I will say this. That was sort of a joke, because I will actually say the two older boys were in, it was the greatest 2 days of their lives. They were so happy walking around with my 8.5-year-old. And he's like, okay, this is the best place ever. This is the best place ever. And I was like, great, it's totally worth it.
It was worth it.
No, it actually was worth it. And the joke was, so as we're getting up to this, I said to Melissa several times, when there was some issue on the way up or even just the planning stages, at every point I would say, this was your idea. Just like a reminder, you know, this was your idea. And I had to say at the end, I said, that was a great trip. The kids,
I'm so glad I had that idea.
No, I gave her credit. I said, this was your idea. So it was all well that ends well, and everybody was happy, and we have lots of family in Philadelphia, and so we did stop by on the way up and the way down to see family. My brother got to hold his youngest nephew, and it was all fine. So, but I really hate people so much more now than I did than before I would like. And that's the real lesson for me.
That's great. Sure beats what I had in the green room.
All right. Shall we move on?
Let's move on.
Too much dudes chatting about my Legoland experience. Let's talk. Should we do box office real quick? Is there anything to say about box office? I mean, Barbie's still at number one. Oppenheimer's still at number two.
If somebody had told you, Sonny, that the QAnon movie was going to gross more domestically than Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning, what should the odds on that prop bet been, say, in May of 2023?
Well, I don't know what you're talking about. There is no QAnon movie out there. There's Sound of Freedom, which is the child trafficking.
Sorry. Yes. Movie, yes. That
which
one
is very different from, you know. No, it's insane. I don't think,
because it is now past Mission Impossible in the domestic box office.
I mean, it's grossed more than Mission Impossible. It's grossed more than Indiana Jones 5. It's grossed more than the Fast and it grossed more than Fast 10.
It grossed more than Flash, but that's not saying
more than the Flash. I mean, it's a legitimate box office phenomenon. So you know, I don't, good for I would not. I mean, I never would have predicted this. I would have guessed it would be in the 20 to 30 million range if it was able to, you know, break out at all.
Right.
Which is not a guarantee with these things. So
question.
Yeah.
Number 5 on this weekend's past weekend's box office. The Last Voyage of the Demeter.
Yes.
What is The Last Voyage of the Demeter?
Have you ever read Bram Stoker's Dracula?
Oh, this is that movie.
So the Bram Stoker's Dracula, there's a chapter in.
Yes,
in,
I'm sorry. I knew
there's
this.
There's a chapter in the novel that's the Captain's Log chapter, which chronicles the voyage from Romania to England.
Yes, where they bring
Dracula, and Dracula kills everybody on the ship, and it comes in derelict. Like this movie is that chapter.
That's basically a great idea.
Yeah, the movie's not very good, sadly. It just didn't work. It's one of these movies that is like everything about it is kind of great on paper. The cast is very good, and the idea is very good, and the director has done some good stuff. And it just does it's too long. It's 2 hours long. It's like repetitive. It's not particularly scary. It has a couple effective sequences, but it's not that good. It's not that
okay.
good.
All right.
No, the only real interesting box office thing is, as of today, so we're taping this Thursday night, as of today, Oppenheimer is now the highest grossing domestic picture ever to not hit number one at the box office, which is an interesting little factoid at $270 million. It's going to make another 50 or 60 million probably. It's going to play for a little while. So, the two biggest box office stories of the summer are Sound of Freedom doing huge business and, you know, Oppenheimer, again, being a 3-hour historical drama.
Flash is a pretty big story.
No, but I mean Flash,
we have both the highs and the lows, right? We have historical bombs and historical.
Yeah, but I feel like I do think that Flash is just. Flash is just part of a different story about the state of the comic book box office and like the whole
worst
DC,
of a bigger story.
The whole DC thing. I mean, we'll see what happens with Blue Beetle this weekend. But you know, Blue Beetle cost $140 million, something like that, and it's gonna open to $25 million this weekend.
$140 million.
Yeah,
it's because of all the stars.
It looks so. George Lopez doesn't work for free,
and the effects.
I knew that movie was in trouble the moment I started seeing all the stories about how this was a really important movie for Hispanic audiences, you know, to finally see themselves. And I was like,
maybe they'll show up though.
Oh shit. They are panicked about this movie.
Audiences are a huge part of the box office.
Right they now. Are. Well,
I don't think people realize how small white people are as a percentage of the total box office.
No, it's true. This is this is why Blue Beetle bombing is like kind of even more impressive, because Hispanic audiences do over index relative to their population.
Yeah.
They generally show up 3 times what their actual population is.
Weekend, the top box office is like 40% white, 35% Hispanic, 35% African American.
Yeah, it's not quite. It depends on the movie. It's not quite like that. That's not too far off. And like, so like the funny thing about Blue Beetle is that it is probably gonna get outgrossed by like some of the last Conjuring sequels, you know, which again index very it over indexes Hispanic very heavily. I'm just saying that like Hispanic audiences are not interested in the George Lopez starring Hispanic superhero movie. They are interested in Evil Nuns. The Nun 2 probably going to outgross Blue Beetle, at least in the opening weekend. So anyway. Again, that's all. That is as with the Flash. This is part of a broader problem with, you know, DC and Warner Brothers and the state of comic book movies in general. So,
well, Well, speaking of white people not going to the theater, the three of us did not go this week for this week's movie. We stayed home and watched this Netflix documentary, Arnold. Sonny, do we need to do a big boy review or just explain what Arnold, the Netflix documentary,
Arnold
is?
Arnold. This is a Netflix, three-part Netflix. This isn't a documentary. This is pure hagiography, and I loved
propaganda.
I loved every second of it. Here's the thing. The thing about Arnold Schwarzenegger, and I believe this very firmly. This is a thing I hold true. Arnold Schwarzenegger is the living embodiment of the American ideal and dream. Like, I'm not saying he's the greatest living American or anything like that. He has his issues. Oh,
that's George W. Bush.
Well, George W. Bush obviously is the greatest living American, but that's, or maybe Zack Snyder, but one of the two, the it's neither here nor there. But Arnold Schwarzenegger is literally the embodiment of the American dream. And this documentary is essentially a three-part look at the various angles of this. I mean, look, he's an immigrant who comes to America and through just sheer will and hard luck or hard work and a little bit of luck and also some wise real estate investments. He becomes an extremely wealthy person. He becomes extremely wealthy, successful.
He marries a fucking Kennedy.
He marries into the Kennedy clan. He marries American royalty. He becomes the most famous person on the planet, the biggest movie star on the planet. He's the most successful actor of his generation. Then becomes governor of the biggest state in the sixth biggest economy in the world, the biggest state in America. Runs that state for a while. And now he has retired to his palatial estates, plural, in California and Austria,
Utah,
everywhere. I mean, he's all over the place.
Austria.
With his like little miniature donkey,
we all agree with him but for the provision of the Constitution, it is 100% certainty that he would have become president.
I think it is very likely. I don't know. Yes. One thing this documentary glosses over, it doesn't really get into how angry the GOP was with Arnold when he left. Like this documentary.
But in 2000 and 2004, I mean, man, I was at those conventions.
Oh, no.
And the reception that he got, and he was where the Republican Party was at that moment.
Totally.
And if he clearly is no longer a Republican.
But, if he had been if he had been able to run for president in 2008, I think his governorship would have been different, and he would have been working more toward appealing to the Republican base, so he could be the Republican nominee in 2008, and he would have been the Republican nominee, and he probably would have won.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's all. I don't know. Arnold Schwarzenegger versus Barack Obama is an interesting counterfactual history.
Could you imagine that?
I don't know. I don't know that Obama would have run. Honestly,
yes.
I feel like if you look at, I think Obama might not have run. It would have been Hillary versus Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he would have won 45 states.
So realigning election.
Totally. Yeah. So much would have been different.
Yeah. Anyway, this documentary is three parts. First part is basically his life in Austria, then his bodybuilding in Europe and in America. Second part is a very cursory look at his movie career. Frankly, the most disappointing part of the documentary, but that's because, again, it's like they have a 15-year stretch to cover, and there are so many different avenues that you could tack. There are like 16 different ways to tell the story of Arnold's rise to prominence, and like, because this is just a movie about how great he is, they don't really touch on any of them. And then it's kind of his personal life, running for governor, his political life, and very gingerly touching on how his family kind of fell apart, or at least how his relationship with Maria Shriver ended. And then it's just now he's looking back on it all from his Sun Valley mansion.
Can we agree that the best part of this is the first one? Like, if you don't want to sit
absolutely
for 3 hours, just watched the first episode, which is about the, you know, him through age 27, basically. Yeah. Right.
So if you, I knew.
You don't need any of the rest of it.
I knew a lot of this stuff, you know, because I, like, again, I just, you know, I consider Arnold to be an extremely interesting person worth knowing about. But if you've seen Pumping Iron, I don't know if you guys have watched Pumping Iron, the documentary.
I never saw it.
So it's amazing. It's kind of amazing. And it's just this, if you go back and watch it, you will see why he became as enormous of a success as he is. And I say this with due respect and admiration, but he's like 80% sociopath. He's like just that asocial enough to like understand exactly how to undermine the people around him he needs to undermine to get where he is. But he does it at the same time in a way that like everybody loves him for it, which is a really, I mean, it's a fascinating personality trait. He is magnetic in a way that that very few people are.
Think about him as the lawful good version of Vince McMahon, right? Where Vince McMahon is able to see his way to power and everybody hates him.
Right.
Arnold is able to do that and in such a way that everybody winds up loving him.
That's right.
So what does that make Vince McMahon? Is he like chaotic evil?
I think so. Maybe I'd have to think. No, he'd probably lawful evil.
He's lawful evil.
Lawful evil. Lawful.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. Anyway, well, no, but he's not lawful evil though, because he's. Oh, anyway, it doesn't matter. We're distracted. The documentary again. It's so cursory. It's only 3 hours, and each section of his life could easily support a 2.5 hour documentary on its own. As JBL says, the opening hour is the most interesting. The second hour is kind of the most cursory and disappointing. But again, there's not much to say other than like. He becomes the biggest movie star in the world, and that's all we're talking about here. The third part is interesting too, because it was so funny watching this, because there's a moment where they talk about him touring the world, going to Iraq to talk about Terminator 3, and I had to reset my mind and be like, oh yeah, Terminator 3 came out at roughly the same time that the invasion of Iraq occurred.
Lies like that was machines.
That was those two things were happening at the same time. And I was just trying to play like in my own head. It's 20 years ago now. I mean, it's half my life ago. And I was trying to, I was like, at the time I was an intern at Radio America, that summer I went to the Czech Republic with Sarah Longwell and the Collegiate Network.
Wow.
Folks that, and I literally saw, Terminator 3, like the day I got back from Prague. I went with my dad to go see it, and I was exhausted and miserable, like probably still kind of drunk. I did not enjoy the movie because I saw it in the wrong mindset.
See the wrong aspect ratio. It's like,
well, it was probably the wrong aspect ratio. I don't know. I was, again, I was very out of it at that. It was not an ideal circumstance. I can peg other like weird cinematic milestones of my life to Arnold's career. Like I remember seeing Kindergarten Cop on a cruise ship going to Sweden or something, you know. I remember Last Action Hero. We had a birthday party for me to go see Last Action Hero. That was like what we did. Because Jurassic Park Too Scary, Last Action Hero, okay. I'm still not entirely sure how my parents worked that one out mentally, but he is one of the key signature American folk heroes of the 20th century. He's just a fascinating figure. And again, I would watch a documentary that gets into like some of the more nitty gritty, some of the more troubling aspects of Arnold's character. But this, for what it is, this is deeply entertaining, and I just enjoy like watching him talk. I could watch him talk for hours on end.
Hmm.
JVL.
I watched it on 1.5 speed and it was still a little slow. I mean, I mean, qua documentary, this is a, if I said to you, could you make Arnold Schwarzenegger's life boring? I mean, you could try, but the subject matter is like, so, you know, it's like, can you shoot Marilyn Monroe ugly? I guess you could take a picture of him that makes him look ugly. After the bodybuilding episode, I think the drag becomes way too much. And the bodybuilding stuff is fascinating. I mean, so much, I don't know, like, you know, he's talking about, right, his home life and how,
yes,
he's a World War II baby, and how, you know, like all these guys are coming home and they were all depressed because they had lost. Like, yeah, because they were the bad guys, yeah, right?
With the baddies.
And he, you know, like he wanted to just get out and get to America because the Americans were the winners, right? And this is when you say an American success story, there's, you know, people say only in America, and what they mean is upward mobility, and that America has both the capacity for upward mobility and the immense machinery to find people with very, very niche talents and make them viable commercial products, right? Like Richard Simmons can only happen in America at the scale that he did, right? You can have a Japanese Richard Simmons. You can have a Ukrainian Richard Simmons or a Brazilian Richard Simmons, but that person can't blow up to the size of the actual American version of Richard Simmons. And only in America can, this is, look, Barack Obama is this.
But it's
Arnold Schwarzenegger is this, right?
It's also the remaking, right? It's the reinvention of yourself.
Yes.
Because yes. I think of what you just described. I think of like Oprah Winfrey is a perfect example too. Like she
who's in the wedding. Did you?
She's in the wedding. I love that.
They show that. The Oprah Winfrey is doing a reading at the wedding of Arnold Schwarzenegger. The three, again, like this steroid head, muscle head from Austria, whose dad lost World War II with the American royalty. With then like Oprah doing everything is
it's
like,
crazy. That's
only nuts. In America.
Only in America.
Only in America.
Yeah.
Did you guys remember Maria Shriver being as dishy as she was? Because I only ever remember Maria Shriver as like, you know, like whatever, like, you know.
You're talking about the younger.
Young, like footage. when the Maria Shriver who went a courting with Arnold. Whew, smoke show.
Yeah. Yeah.
I
agree.
It. So, I would say that very quickly about the bodybuilding. Two things that struck me: the 60s and 70s were just a magical time. I guess a time when incredibly large dudes could go into a forest by a lake and just get all naked and work out with each other over and over and over and over and over again for hours on end and oil each other up and watch each other while they're, and it wasn't gay. That's amazing. Which is a thing, by the way, that happens in Austria, yeah, right? Arnold is, he has his workout buddies.
And then it's a thing that happens in America. They just, instead of in the forest, it's Venice Beach.
Right. Well, in Venice Beach, you're doing it as performance. In the forest, they're just alone together. I mean, it's being in the Roman, you know, Greco-Roman gymnasium. Have you ever seen gladiator movies, Graf? And this, you know, they're in there and the weirdness of it. And the guys, like the middle-aged men who come to watch the bodybuilders, I couldn't, so much of it, it's like a Tobias Funke vibe to the whole thing, where, you know, like, oh, boy Michael, girl Michael. Like, wow. What? It's just weird as shit. Yeah.
Can I say, I had a similar thought, but it was more that the whole thing was like, grotesque to me, like the things that they're bodies are, you know, like Arnold talks a lot about in the documentary about, you know, I have this perfect body, you know, I was making my body even more perfect. And it's like, is it though? Because it looks disgusting and grotesque to, you know, it's like muscles on muscle. Like I wow.
There's someone that someone hates excellence over here.
Well, yeah. But like I was thinking more actually of
the aside on steroids was fascinating. Yeah, no, and of course I was using a lot of steroids at the time.
Right.
Everybody
was doing
4 months
it.
And
the important thing was that it was sparing, you know, it was disciplined. It was only every 4 months.
5%, you know, maybe 5% of what I have was
yeah,
for
I love
steroids.
How we quantify that. No, I was thinking of when he's in America and they're like interviewing the people, maybe this is in Pumping Iron, they're interviewing the people who are coming to see him, Arnold, in like, I think it's in some
museum. At the Whitney in New York.
Yeah.
Yes, people bought tickets.
And they're like talking to like, you know, like art society women outside. And they're like, I don't know what I'm going to see in here. And it's like, it's so bizarre. And
we took the freak show. It's a freak show thing, but yes, they classed it up. And it's fascinating in that way. Yes.
So, yeah. So a couple thoughts. One, I did not like this as much as you did, Sonny. And maybe it was the second 2 hours, like the diminishing returns soured it for me. It became increasingly clear that this was pro Arnold propaganda that it was always clear, but it was like so on the nose, it just turned me off. The political stuff I thought was so breezy. It like breezed over all of this stuff. It really glossed over the fact that actually Arnold didn't know what the fuck he was doing when he was like, especially at the beginning as governor, right? Like he sort of says, you know, I am so impatient and that's why it's like, no, he actually, when the Democratic state Senate president or whoever, there's like that great footage where they're like, where he's like yelling at Arnold in the state house or something. And he's like, thanks a lot. Cause you fucked my bill. And like, that's like real politics. And like, Arnold is kind of like, ha ha ha, you know? And it's like, actually he just like, he really didn't get it. And I thought they kind of glossed over that. And I get it. It's hey, yeah.
I mean, I would watch a 90 minute, one-on-one interview with Mike Murphy about
totally.
That.
Yes. Oh, it was great to see Mike pop up. I was like, oh, hey, look, it's Mike.
Just Murphy. Like, let's get 90 minutes with Mike Murphy here talking about what he thought about Arnold and his campaign.
But I thought there was too much Arnold, you know, like he was so dominant in it that I felt.
Yes. Sell his own story.
Yeah, exactly. I mentioned the thing about the grotesque bodybuilding. I agree. The movie section was so, I mean, it was weird what they left out, and maybe we'll get into this in the bonus episode, but you know, no mention of Kindergarten Cop, basically. There's no mention of Total Recall. No mention of Jingle All the Way. Like, he mentions certain flops, but not others. He mentions certain hits, but not others. I just thought that was kind of interesting. And then, did you guys, maybe I'm just cynical, or maybe I'm like not cynical enough, but the ending of every episode, and particularly the ending of the last one, after you hear about his family falling apart, Arnold's in these giant houses that he owns and he's all alone.
He looks very lonely.
He looks miserable and
running around with his little animals.
And like, I can't believe I'm saying this. I felt sorry for him and like, you know, and not in like a look at that pathetic guy, but like I generally, because I love Arnold Schwarzenegger, and I felt like this is a lonely, broken man who achieved
like
excellence.
King Lear sitting on a throne in an empty castle.
And it made me sad. It made me very sad. I'm glad you guys saw the same thing.
I don't want to end on a sad note, so I would like to share a story that I don't know if either of you will remember, because it may... Were either of you at the Standard when he was running for governor?
No.
Okay. So he announces he's running for governor, and of course, what do we do with the Weekly Standard?
Sent Matt Labash?
Yes. Yes. We sent Matt Labash out to do a hangout piece with Arnold. And because we have the ins with Mike Murphy, we're able to get him right on in, and Matt flies from flies from DC to LA, and I believe in the telling of the story, goes directly from his commercial flight over to the private terminal and gets on Arnold's plane with him. And, you know, he's come from DC, so he's got like a coat and stuff. And Arnold is sitting at the conference table in the plane reading the paper. And one of the functionaries says, you know, can I take your coat? And Matt says, no, I'm fine. I'm good. And Arnold, without looking up, goes, that's because he's ashamed of his body. He doesn't want us to see that he's a little flabby girly man.
So great. Even when he's cutting you down, you love him. That's this. That's the Arnold charm.
That's it.
This is what I'm talking about. This is what I'm talking. Like 80% sociopath.
Yes.
But just charming enough that like nobody holds it against him. Nobody. You know,
if he said it in an American accent, he would just be an asshole. So much of it is the Austrian accent, the funny way he talks.
No, but also there's the self-awareness, right? There's the, he's so in on the joke that it's like Arnold doing Hans and Franz from Saturday Night Live doing Arnold. And he knows that his bit is like a, you know,
schmuck. What was the German word?
Schmay.
Yeah. He's bullshit.
Yeah. It's just a fascinating, fascinating guy. And only in America.
All right. So, any other thoughts on Arnold before we wrap things up? Sonny? Nothing?
No. I mean, I don't think you guys are wrong that especially the last 2 hours are kind of like, the problem you're looking at 20 years of the guy's life you got to cover in an hour, and you listed three movies, and the one I was most interested in was Jingle All the Way. Like, there, how much time should they spend on Jingle All the Way?
Well, my point
on an episode like this, like, but you see what I mean? Like, when I say that there are like 15 different ways you could look at Arnold, this is what I'm talking about. Like, you could look at the rise of Arnold as like the defining muscle man action hero of that generation. You could look at him as the guy who was able to understand that to become the true global superstar, he had to appeal to women, and to appeal to women, he had to do comedies. He had to make Twins and Kindergarten Cop. Or you could look at the sequel man. You could look at him as teaming up with Bruce Willis and Sly Stallone on the restaurant on, you know,
Hollywood.
I mean, like there are like so many different ways. And then you could look at the fall of all this, right? You look at starting with Last Action Hero and how that whole era comes to an end, and how he is still able to kind of make it work for a period of time. And frankly, one of the reasons he ran for governor was because it was like, all right, my time as a movie star is at an end. Like his reign was over, and it was like, okay, what's the next thing? And again, so like, again, there, I totally agree with you guys that this is cursory and hagiographic. And, as somebody who likes a good hagiography of somebody I like, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
But like it, you know, I the business angle of Arnold Schwarzenegger would be a fascinating like 2.5 hour documentary all on its own. I mean, this is one of the reasons why, I'm sorry, I'm rambling here, but this is one of the reasons why Edward J. Epstein's book on Hollywood business is so interesting, because he got a hold of Arnold's contract. Yeah, his books. I forget what I think it's called The Big Picture.
Yep.
But he got a hold of one of Arnold's contracts, and like a large portion of his kind of construction of helping people understand how the industry works was just like breaking down dollar by dollar what Arnold was getting paid for. And it's fascinating. I mean, he was one of the first guys to take, you know, big first dollar grosses. He was one of the first guys to, you know, insist on,
you know, a lot like Michael Jordan's mother in that way.
Yes, very much. Very much.
I would say these episodes are not packed to the gills. I mean, Sonny, I would say that they could have found time to do Kindergarten Cop, because this thing moves so slowly. Like they just aren't propulsive enough, and there's a lot of dead space in them.
It's also just weird that they have interviews with Lyndall Hamilton and Danny DeVito and James Cameron and Ivan Reitman, who's R.I.P.
Yeah.
And they just they have them say the most cursory things.
Yes.
Imaginable.
The most surface level.
Like it's like there's not an interest. It's not like James Cameron is telling an interesting story from the set of True Lies or anything. It's just like Arnold is, and then he ran for governor, and we were like, Arnold, what?
Yeah, Jamie
he's
Lee Curtis is like
governor.
Jamie Lee Curtis, with
let
like
me
going
have my name above the line.
Yeah, yeah. No, and, my favorite was from the third one where she's like, where they're going through all of his friends from Hollywood, and they're like reacting to him running for governor, and Jamie Lee Curtis is like, I heard it and I thought, yeah. It's like,
well,
oh, right.
Well, that was that
wonderful
was,
insight.
That was also very funny though, because if you, I think if you're reading between the lines, when you're looking at Linda Hamilton and Danny DeVito and James Cameron's reaction to it, they're all kind of like, he's running as a Republican?
Yeah.
And Jamie Lee Curtis is just like, yeah, he's going to win.
Yeah, that's
gonna,
right. Yeah.
He's going to win.
He's going to win.
It was very interesting. Again, like, I feel like maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I did feel like there was a very specific thing going on there.
The last thing I'll say is that in terms of what a documentary, a really good documentary could be, there was a shade of it when Everett was talking about his father and his relationship with his family. And it felt like there were these moments that where things might even break through, where there's actually some real Arnold coming through. And then he like gets out of it real quick. But just like the descriptions of his parents growing up with them, the mother scrubbing the floors, you know, the things about his brother, and his, like, I was like, get me into that. Like, I want to watch a bunch of stuff about Arnold's, this bizarre man who had to escape this family. What is that family really like? And there are shades
of it. I want to know about the Miami photographer who all he does is take pictures of male bodybuilders. That is, you catch that? Like, is this little 5'2" middle-aged man who lives in Miami, and he is, oh, he just loves taking pictures, and, you know, he
you need
goes
a
down
whole
to the gym with the boys.
To get into that, JVL,
like
you need
to know
a whole
what that's all
90
about.
Minutes.
Okay. I'd like to know what that's all about.
Well, I can, after the show's over, I'll give me about 10 seconds. I'll explain what it's all about. All right. I think that's all the time we're giving to this episode. Check us out at subbeacon.com, and we'll see you next time.
We're going to do an Arnold draft, right? We're going to pick Arnold movies?
You know, the documentary sadly does not include one of Arnold's greatest witticisms, which is when he notes that he used to make films with Jim Cameron back during his art house period.
I love that.
Which, Arnold, he's very clever.
He's funny.
He's funny as shit.
He's just a funny guy. There was a, speaking of True Lies and Cameron and Arnold, there was a funny story that was I'd seen before, but was going around Twitter again this week. But it was because it was James Cameron's birthday this week, and somebody was like, let's all remember the time that James Cameron it was 95 or 96. He had he was celebrating his 50th birthday or something, and was like, I'm going to go see Stanley Kubrick. That's what I'm going to do, because, you know, we've been pen pals, and, you know, it's, and so he goes to Stanley Kubrick's house, and Stanley invites him in. He's like, come in, James, come in. Let's go downstairs into my basement, where he pulls out a print of True Lies. Stanley Kubrick pulls out a print that he has of True Lies, and he spools it in, and he starts going through the movie, and he says, Jim, how did you do this? How did you do this special effect here? How did you get this shot on the bridge where you're blowing it up? And James is like, well, you know, we did this shot and this effect, and then Stanley would like nod and be like, how did you do this? And just like through the whole movie, just a shot by shot breakdown of True Lies, which is the thing I don't think people really appreciate about Stanley Kubrick is that he was a true fan of genre. Like, yeah, you just have to look at his filmography. He made a horror movie. He made comedies. He made action movies. He made war movies. Like, he really likes genre filmmaking.
Costume dramas.
Yep.
He was a real student of True Lies, which is great, because True Lies is one of the great underrated action films of the 90s. So,
yeah, it's no Eraser, though.
I'm sure it's fine.